91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program is with Florida Memorial University History Professor Tamika Bradley Hobbs and her University Press of Florida book, Democracy Abroad, Lynching at Home, Racial Violence in Florida. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Florida is often viewed historically as a more progressive, atypical southern state. But when it came to racial violence during the 1940s, anti-black violence continued in Florida, while lynchings and firebombing declined in other Deep South areas. Professor Hobbs suggests that while African-American soldiers fought for global democracy against the Axis powers, bigoted individuals inflicted racial violence and murder in the Sunshine State. We'll learn more in minutes after NPR and regional news.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. It's today's edition. This hour we visit with Florida Memorial University history professor and author Dr. Tamika Bradley Hobbs. She's written a book which explains how racial violence and lynchings continued in Florida into the 1940s.
While waning elsewhere, it studies the lynchings of four black men in the Sunshine State and also chronicles the effect the brutality had on families and the African-American population at large. It's titled Democracy Abroad, Lynching at Home, Racial Violence in Florida.
The book received a 2015 Florida Book Bronze Award and a 2016 award from the Florida Historical Society. Dr. Tamika Bradley Hobbs joins us now in the studio. Welcome to you, Doctor.
Great to be here, Joe and Bonnie.
Really nice to have you. Thanks so much for coming. You know, as I was reading your book, Professor, it reminded me of the feeling I get when I see or read something new about the Holocaust, and I'm horrified all over again. And I'm not comparing them per se, but as much as I've read and heard and think I know about the history of racism and violence against African Americans in America general, and particularly in Florida, I was stunned and horror-struck repeatedly. And I'm wondering how much of this came as a shock to you as you were researching it.
I think I was generally aware of the brutality that African Americans faced, just in terms of my own coming to terms with black history. I took my first African-American history class at Florida A&M University in Tallahassee, and it absolutely blew my top. I learned about things that I had never heard before, people had never heard before. It put into context so much of my life growing up in Live Oak, Florida. And then when I had a professor, I mentioned him in the credits and introduction of the book, Dr. Theodore Hemingway, who said to me one day, "I bet you don't know they lynched a boy in Live Oak." He was talking about lynching. I was sitting in class horrified. But then for him to personalize it that way and tell me that there had been something that took place in my hometown, there I'd lived there my entire life, and I'd never heard about it. I was a little incredulous, but on my next visit, I went home and talked to my grandfather, who's now deceased. And that was the first conversation that we'd had about race. He was kind of the leader of our family, minister, very stern figure. But when we talked that day and he told me, "I remember when they lynched that boy. I remember there was a time if I was walking into town and there was a white woman who was coming along the street, I would turn around and go home just to avoid the likelihood that anything could happen to him, any accusation could be made against him." So it was a really kind of a illuminating conversation, and it really marked my foray into the world of lynching and racial violence. And so as you research, as I research this and other topics, I think it was initially shocking. I've been doing it so long now, I unfortunately have a little bit of I'm used to it, but I live it all over again as I go around the state and I talk to different audiences. And like you, Bonnie, when they have these very strong reactions, it just reminds me of how really terrible these instances are. But even more than that, I think when we talk about way that we were taught about America and its democracy and what it represents, liberty for all and justice and the meaning of our legal code, to know that things like this could take place for such long periods of time. When we talk about the lynching era in America, it really does call into question everything that we have claimed that we are.
I was very struck by your grandfather relating and remembering the terror that black men had to feel near white people, not to offend in any way,
because, including white men, too.
Of course, but to make sure that they gave no offense or any reason for violence to begin, sort of a To Kill a Mockingbird attitude.
Yeah, I mean, it was a code that was a part of racial etiquette, and it was a matter of life and death. It was something that black parents had to teach to their children. In very painful ways to ensure their survival. When we talk about getting off the sidewalk, not making eye contact, taking off your hat, making sure that you used handles, Mr. Mrs., that you stayed in your place. Mm. All of those things were a matter of life and death.
Almost like a leper.
Mm-hmm. And in particular, the taboo of black men interacting with white women. There was a deadline that was to separate those. In many of the cases that I write about, particularly the case that takes place in Live Oak that I first learned about, for generations, the story of Willie James Howard becomes a cautionary tale for young black men who are there. And it's even more complicated when you think about the impact that it has on the family structure. Most of the victims of lynching that we know of were men, predominantly African-American men in the South. When they are killed, when they are taken out, very often they are the breadwinners for their families. They are fathers. They are part of a support network. And what you very often have is black women who are left to fend for themselves. I take this up in the epilogue to my book because I think that, you know, we focus so much on the male victims that we don't really spend enough time understanding the impact on the broader family and society. And those things are very, very important. Even the emasculation. I spent a lot of time thinking and writing about James Howard, the father of Willie James, who had to stand by helpless while his son jumped to his death in the Suwannee River in 1944. What was it like for him after those moments to watch his namesake and his only child be killed and know that there was really nothing that he could do? He could not protect himself. He could not protect his family. And then you kind of expand beyond that and think about the psychological impact over generations that has had. I think it's something that we don't talk enough about.
Right. Well, we're going to do a little history of lynching, but I want to take the title of your book. I'd like to put the lynching in historical, you know, context, especially because of the way it continued in Florida in the 40s as opposed to everywhere else. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to take the title of your book and the cruel irony therein, because here are the Americans engaged abroad fighting a war against tyranny, Nazism, fascism, racism, fighting for the preservation of democratic ideals, while some Americans back home are denying those very rights to African Americans. So if you would address that paradox, and you had mentioned something in your book that you thought would...
Yeah, there's a section I'd like to read from the book that does really take this up and gets to the essence of the argument that I'm attempting to make in the entire work. The lynchings of Arthur C. Williams and Quincy in 1941, Celis Harrison in Marianna in 1943, Willie James Howard in Live Oak in 1944, and Jesse James Paine in Madison in 1945 are but a small but important part of the United States' bloody lynching legacy. Each incident elicited varied responses of the local, state, and federal government, as well as the American public. With the onset of World War II and its portrayal by the Roosevelt administration as a war to preserve democracy in the world, more Americans became keenly aware of the injustice lynching represented and its glaring inconsistency with U.S. war aims. Shifting priorities in the national level, especially achieving the moral authority necessary to command respect abroad, demanded that America directly address the issue of civil rights for all Americans. As a result, public servants and politicians attempted to balance the traditional acceptance of lynching and black oppression with the fascism the United States fought against in World War II. The lynchings examined in this study outline shifting trends in anti-Black violence, particularly how the practice of extralegal murder transformed after the 1930s, and perhaps more importantly, how the response of the American public changed in response to continued lynching violence.
What was the role of, or how did you view the role of newspapers and radio and coverage of these events in the 1940s in Florida?
There, in terms of the white press, the mainstream press at this point in time in the 1940s, there was some small role. Locally, you do see, especially by the time we get to 1945 and the lynching of Jesse James Paine, a little more coverage. But more nationally, I think you see national press becoming more interested. There is the case of Westbrook Pegler, who I talk about in the case of the lynching of Arthur Williams, who has a nationally syndicated column. And he just chastises in the public newspapers the community of Quincy where this lynching took place. And the citizens and state senators took great offense to that. And there's this campaign on the part of some Floridians, particularly in North Florida, to try to get his column pulled because of the insult that he has made against the state. But all of this is good, ultimately, because it is shedding more light on this type of violence as it's taking place in America.
But did regional and local newspapers and radio outlets gloss over some of these things or even tacitly approve?
Yes, they did, most certainly. There was always, if there was anything written, there was always an assumption that the victim deserved what he got. There was not much questioning beyond that. But I did want to point out the role of the African-American press, because they, for me, are really the heroes in the story in attempting to use the tools that they had, their papers, along with the rhetoric that existed during the day, of the irony, as Bonnie pointed out, the United States being engaged in this war against fascism internationally and being horrified by the information that's coming out about the way that Jewish people were being treated, but yet turning a blind eye to the situation that African Americans faced in the South on a daily basis.
Let's take a break right now. We're speaking with Dr. Tamika Bradley-Hobbs. She's an assistant professor of history and the university historian at Florida Memorial University and the interim chair in the Department of Social Sciences. This is an award-winning book. It's called Democracy Abroad, Lynching at Home, Racial Violence in Florida. We'll be right back.
And we return with today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Florida Memorial University history professor and author Dr. Tamika Bradley-Hobbs. We're talking about her book called Democracy Abroad, Lynching at Home, Racial Violence in Florida. Why did Florida lynching seem to peak in the 1940s after other Deep South states it declined, the Alabamas, Mississippi, Louisianas?
Mm-hmm. It's not so much that lynchings peaked in Florida. I think Florida definitely is a part of a trend where there are fewer, but it is a bit of an anomaly that you still have so many of them happening in this decade. And one of the things that I try to make in this book is that while Florida numerically did not have as many lynchings as some of the states that you mentioned, between 1882 and roughly 1930, there were about 331 that took place in the state. Those latest estimates have been bumped up by about 50 after some recent investigations. If you look at the likelihood of being lynched, the rate per capita of being lynched based on the African-American population, Florida was number one in the nation. More than Mississippi, more than Alabama, more than some of these states that are more recognizable when we talk about racial violence. And the question is why? Why was that the case in Florida? Well, if you understand Florida's economy during this period in time, before we were Disney, you know, before we were this tourist state, it was very much about agriculture. In the northern region of Florida, growing tobacco and other crops, and central and south Florida, the orange groves and other fruits and vegetables, it was necessary for the vitality of those industries that you maintain control of a cheap source of labor. And so lynching was a part of a very complex system that existed throughout the state, throughout the South, really, to maintain this economic control over Black workers. And it was a part of a system that included vagrancy laws, where people who couldn't prove that they had jobs were arrested. They were leased out to sometimes turpentine camps, sometimes orange groves and made to labor. You had sheriffs who acted as enforcers of these laws and were very often taking kickbacks from the grove owners and other plantation owners in order to facilitate this type of behavior. So it's a very complex machinery, but the terrorism that's represented in lynching helped to maintain the economic structure that existed during this in the state during this time.
What happened? There was a time after the Civil War during Reconstruction with the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that African Americans did enjoy a period of relative peace and a modicum of racial equality. What happened that caused it to go back? You're looking like they did not.
No, I mean, I think that when we look at the period after emancipation, the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment giving African American citizenship, the 15th Amendment giving black men the right to vote in 1870, there was the promise and the hope. Of course, things are better because you're not enslaved, but what you see is that there is an immediate backlash on the parts of whites in the South. You have here in Florida, Jackson County. They talk about the Jackson County War in 2 years between, I think it's 1870 and 1872. There are almost 150 people who were murdered in that one county. Why? Because there was a threat to white supremacy. Now that not only blacks were free, but black men had the right to vote, they had the right to hold office, there was a real fight for who would control politics and government in the state of Florida. Florida was pretty interesting. During that period, we did have an African-American serve as Secretary of Education. There were other high-ranking blacks who served throughout the state. We had someone who served as Secretary of State as well. But it was an unfulfilled promise.
Well, I mean, I would suppose it also depended on that the white men were re-enfranchised after Reconstruction, so once again had political power.
Sure. But it was, as soon as they could, though, they worked to put laws in place that disenfranchised African Americans using literacy tests, poll taxes, all types of not only legal but extra legal means. When we talk about the rise of lynching violence and when we really begin to track those numbers, it is around the 1880s. So if you look at black men getting the right to vote in 1870, you have about 10 years roughly before the state is able to come in and basically through legal means undermine the promise of the 15th Amendment. So, well, I think there was on paper the opportunity for and hope that things would get better. The reality is that it was never substantiated, and you enter into the period of Jim Crow, not only in Florida, but throughout the South. There's a fantastic book by Carol Anderson. She's at Emory University. It's called White Rage. We use that as a teaching tool, but she talks about that, and the premise of the book actually came out of the rioting after Ferguson and Baltimore, when there was no indictment in either of those cases for the killing of Mike Brown or Freddie Gray. And people were talking about all of the rioting and the fires and why are these people burning down their own communities. What Dr. Anderson proposed in her Washington Post op-ed and later in the book is that what you saw was really smoke. The fire was white rage. And that when whites have a reaction, when they push back against black gains, it doesn't look like a riot. It looks like legislation. It looks like, you know, law enforcement funding. It looks like the war on drugs. And so we have to kind of change our understanding of those dynamics in our country's history.
Since we're talking a lot about the 1940s, could you please discuss the two governors who were in power then, namely Governor Spessard Holland and also Millard Caldwell? Both were strong segregationists.
Yes. They are the two governors who happen to be in office during the period that I write about. And they are really caught on the hot seat. The state is going through a lot of change. Of course, when we talk about the lead up to World War II, the United States entry into World War II, what that meant for the state is, as it became a military training site, is that there's this population boom. There's all of these elements that need to be managed. And at the same time, there is this very traditional attitude towards race in the state. And so you have these two governors really being caught in the middle of kind of the traditions of the past when it came to racial attitudes.
Constituencies.
And, you know, a federal government, particularly under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who after the lynching in Sikeston, Missouri in 1942, mandates that his Department of Justice investigate any lynching incident that takes place. So you have a federal government that, while it never could muster the will to pass a federal anti-lynching law, is now signaling that it is no longer willing to turn a blind eye to these types of instances.
And there were anti-lynching laws that were proposed time and time again, and they never were able to pass.
Never able to pass. One of the things that I write about is the fact that our own Claude Pepper in 1937 participated in a filibuster against one of these anti-lynching laws. He spoke for 11 hours on the floor of the Senate in an attempt to block, a successful attempt to block this piece of legislation. And, you know, reading that is really terrible. I know it's very shocking to people who know Claude Pepper in his later years. He was very, you know, progressive and did a lot of positive things. But when you read what he was saying on the floor of the Senate in 1937, all based on a premise of white supremacy, that this land and this government was designed for white men, and they're the only ones who will ever be able to have a stake in it. It really does give you an embodiment of the sentiment of the time, that this was necessary in order to maintain the appropriate, what many people saw as the appropriate demographic, control power structure in the South during this period in time.
Something I also found disturbing, you know, we're going to get to the four lynchings, obviously, that are the focus of your book. I mean, but it's all this that's the focus of you focus on. But something I really found disturbing was that it sounds like the bad publicity caused by the lynchings was one of the key factors that explained why some people within Florida got involved and made efforts to stop it. Not because it was a crime, not because it was inhumane, but because they didn't want the bad publicity because they wanted the people to still come to Florida and visit Florida and move to Florida.
You hit it exactly on the head. And I would even push it back another level. The only reason the state got more concerned is because the federal government, FDR, the Department of State, was becoming increasingly alarmed by the international image of the United States. When you think about the wind down of World War II, when you think about us beginning down the path of being in conflict with the Soviet Union and the you know, kind of lead up to the Cold War, there is an ideological battle between democracies and dictators. And the United States wanted to win that ideological battle, but the State Department acknowledged that the Achilles heel in this country was race relations. And there was no stronger example of the failure of American democracy to care for the least of those.
The Soviets were pointing out our dirty laundry.
Right.
Well, they were actually, the communists at the time were actually more vocal against lynching and the Japanese, I believe it was, than the Americans.
Mm-hmm. They were very interested. These incidents that take place in the United States in the 30s and 40s would end up as propaganda for the Soviets, for the Japanese, and the State Department was aware of this. So at the federal level, it was the concern about the international image of the United States as we come to the close of World War II that forced them to put pressure on the state. And then you have governors like Spessard Hahn, like Millard Caldwell, who were then, you know, riding the fence between, you know, explaining and deflecting the national attention, but also trying to keep their constituents happy. And so it's a very difficult position. I argue that they're able to change their posture just enough to have the appearance that they were paying attention. Mm-hmm. But when we look at what actually came out of these investigations, there was no one ever bought to.
Spessard Hahn was also quite a mentor to the very progressive Lawton Chiles.
You just said how nobody was brought to account. We're going to get to the lynchings. I think now would be a good time to take our break before we start. And we're speaking about the book with Professor Tamika Bradley Hobbs, her book, Democracy Abroad, Lynching at Home, Racial Violence in Florida. On today's Topical Currents, we'll be right back.
And we're back 31 minutes past 1 o'clock. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Florida Memorial University history professor and author, Dr. Tamika Bradley Hobbs. If you'd like to join in the discussion, you're certainly welcome for a comment or question. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email. Please keep them as short as possible. radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org.
Okay, I'd like to focus on the lynchings, and I'm not beginning chronologically. I want to begin with Willie James Howard because he was the impetus for this book, mm-hmm. and his lynching was all but forgotten. It was done in your hometown of Live Oak. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Willie James Howard was a 15-year-old youth who was working in the Five and Dime store around the Christmas season, 1943. He had a co-worker, Cynthia Goff, a young white girl who was about his same age. The story goes that he'd given Christmas cards to all of his co-workers and that she had been offended by the way that he closed the card. Maybe he said, love, with love. And there's the issue of a note. In one version of the story, he wrote her a note. It was supposed to be a note of apology, but it is a more flirtatious note. He says to Cynthia, if we were in a northern state, maybe things would be different. I love your name. I love your voice. For a sweetheart, you are my choice. And it's this note, supposedly, that her father, who is a former Florida state senator, Alex Goff, finds and is enraged. And he and two other men go to the Howard home on the morning of Sunday, January 2nd. They kidnap the 15-year-old Willie James from his mother at gunpoint. They then put him in the car. They go to the Bon Howell lumber yard where his father was working that day, picked up his father also at gunpoint, and they drive to the edge of the Suwannee River. And they say to Willie James, you have a choice. You can either take what's in the gun or you can jump into the river. Willie James opted to jump into the Suwannee River where he drowned. Now, what's interesting about this, and not only in the case of Willie James Howard, but a technique that I use throughout the book is I use oral history. I talk to African Americans in the community to learn their understanding of what had happened to Willie James Howard. And what I learned from several of his classmates is that he was a very affable young man, always happy, really jolly. His nickname was Giddy Boy, which is, you know, some indication of his personality. But that he loved to sing, and then he was always singing. And that this particular situation at the Five and Dime developed when Cynthia Goff asked him to write down the lyrics to a song that he was singing and she really liked. One of my interview subjects, who since passed away, told me the exact name of the song. If this isn't love, it'll have to do until then. When on my second round of research in Live Oak, as I was preparing the manuscript, I found another woman who was in her 90s who claimed to have been in the store that day and heard an exchange where Cynthia was asking Willie James to write these things down. And so it's very interesting to look at the difference between the two of them, because in one version, the mainstream version, I'll call it, Willie James was a foolish boy who was stepping across, again, this deadline that separates black men and white women in the South. And some would argue that what else did he expect to have happen? On the other hand, when we look at the oral history that was maintained in the African-American situation, Willie James becomes a innocent victim of brutal, aggressive white men who simply misunderstood his intention. This was simply a song. He was simply responding to a request, and he lost his life unnecessarily, but incredibly tragic. And it's interesting to me that this incident happens in 1944, a full 11 years before Emmett Till. But we all, you know, are pretty familiar with the contours and context of what happens to Emmett Till. There's so much that happens here in the state of Florida that actually forecast a lot of the violence that we see in some of the, you know, mainstream civil rights struggle. You can also compare here in the state of Florida, Harry T. Moore and his martyrdom to that of Medgar Evers in 1963. Moore, of course, was killed in 1951.
The NAACP.
Mm-hmm. Moore is just a phenomenal figure in Florida's history. He's a native of Suwannee County, where Live Oak is. He's actually a graduate of Florida Memorial College when it was in that town, 1925.
And in the 40s, he headed the NAACP here.
He founded the the Florida chapter of the NAACP, and does that for years. But in that role, he is investigating lynchings. He appears several times in my work because of his advocacy, trying to get the national NAACP on the case, writing to the governors. He's a real thorn in their side.
So he actually brings some attention, or tried to bring attention to these lynchings.
He is the foremost anti-lynching advocate in the state of Florida during this period of years. And part of that is actually going to bring him to the attention of the Klan, which ultimately it was the Klan that assassinated him and his wife in 1951.
So the next incident.
Celis Harrison was really interesting. Celis Harrison was lynched in 1943 in Marianna, which is up in Jackson County in the Panhandle. I dedicate two chapters in my book to that story because it really does help to flesh out the transitional period that I'm trying to argue that we see happening here in the state of Florida. Marianna had the great misfortune of being the site of a very terrible spectacle lynching, the lynching of Claude Neal in 1934. There were thousands of people who came into the town. He was brutally tortured and lynched. And so when there is an accusation against Celis Harrison that he's killed a white man, there's a real effort on the part of the power structure in Marianna not to have another lynching. Instead of a extra legal murder, which is what lynching is, a killing outside of the authority of the state, they were trying to proceed with what we call in the field a legal lynching. It's a lynching using the mechanism of the criminal justice system where you know what the outcome is going to be. You know that the alleged perpetrator is going to be put to death. But what happens in the case of Celis Harrison is that Celis Harrison has the good fortune of having a good, vigorous defense attorney by the name of Benjamin Franklin Barnes. I've had the good benefit of meeting his daughter and learning more about him. And I still don't have a really strong motivation as to why Ben Barnes was such a strong advocate for Celis Harrison, but I would argue that he helps to extend his life by at least a year. There is an issue in the case of Celis Harrison of a forced confession. He's being driven from Marianna to Quincy to Tallahassee at high rates of speed. The law enforcement officers are telling him that he's being pursued by people who want to lynch him, and the only way to save his life is that if he confesses, and so he does so. And it's that confession that Ben Barnes attempts to have thrown out of court. He takes his appeal to the Florida Supreme Court, and they decide in his favor. They send him back for retrial. Barnes then tries to get the confession thrown out altogether, and eventually the Florida Supreme Court does agree. And it's interesting with the Florida Supreme Court because they, too, had recently been chastised by the U.S. Supreme Court. They had, in the case of Chambers versus Florida, not disavowed what was clearly a forced confession for African-American men in Brevard County who had been accused of murder. But in this devastating opinion by the U.S. Supreme Court, they'd really smacked down the Florida Supreme Court. So I argue, too, that because things are changing at the federal level, that the state is having to respond in a different way. And so when Celis Harrison comes to them with another forced confession, they are more sensitive to it and do fall in his favor. But back in Marianna, after it becomes clear that they're not going to be able to achieve this legal lynching, they opt for a traditional lynching. Celis Harrison is kidnapped from jail and taken out and killed with an axe along the side of a road. So that's how that story ends up. But again, that case is also very interesting when we talk about the involvement of the federal government. The FBI is on the scene in Jackson County conducting interviews for 9 months after Celis Harrison is killed. No other time have I seen something like that take place. And you just imagine what that meant for the white community and not only Marianna in Jackson County, but throughout the state of Florida. It sends a very strong message that you cannot continue to engage in these types of behavior and expect not to be held accountable.
But even though there was collusion between law officers and the lynchers, no one was ever brought to justice.
No. And there are limits to that, right? I think it is, on the one hand, a big step forward for the Department of Justice and FBI to be on the scene. from what I've read, I think they had enough evidence to kind of press a little bit more. But I don't really think, in my judgment, that there was will on their part to really go in. Because think about the other reality is that even if the Department of Justice did want to prosecute someone, they're still going to get a local jury that more than likely would fail to indict anyone that, you know, they was brought to trial. And so it's still, you know, very difficult to achieve justice in these sort of systems.
We know how the white communities are responding to these lynchings, and we know how the mobs are responding and the local officials. And we want to also say at this time, lynching had changed. It wasn't a mob scene anymore. It was a smaller number of people. They were done a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
But what was the response of the African-American community in Marianna, for example, or in Quincy, or in any of these places?
First point, when you talk about the change of the size,
yes,
it's a very important indicator because that is a part of the transition that I argue. Because they're not doing this in the daylight, because they're not large numbers of people participating or watching, there is some fear that there may be someone who is going to come along and ask questions and possibly investigate. So that's a very important trend to keep our finger on. In terms of the African-American community, you know, again, these are people who for generations now have witnessed these types of instances. But at the same time, the experience of World War II is going to change African-Americans and their response to this. At the time that the war is being fought, the mantra among blacks in America is double victory, victory abroad and victory at home, that we're not going to take our eyes off of the prize in fighting for civil rights in our own country while we also help to fight this international struggle. So you're going to see a variety of responses. The one I like to focus on is what happens in these families. These families are exploded. They're never the same. As I said, these primarily women are left without breadwinners. In the case of Arthur Williams and Quincy, it divides his family. His mother is devastated. She takes his 9-year-old sister, who I talked to when I was conducting my my interviews and heard some horrific things from her. But she never lives with her father and brothers again. They leave Florida for East St. Louis, Illinois, and never look back. She has to deal with a mother who is depressed and grieving for years. She harbors anger for whites for years in her own life. Celis Harrison, his wife and mother, flee the area for New York City. So when we talk about the Great Migration, this, you know, huge flux of African Americans who leave the South for the North starting in the 1910 and extending through this period, you have to understand that part of the reason that people are leaving the South is because of these instances of lynching and racial violence. In the case of Jesse James Payne, the family does leave the state. They end up in Detroit. As a matter of fact, they sought me out because they, cousins in Detroit and cousins who were in Sanford, Florida, who had never met each other, were now coming into contact, and they had found my dissertation online and were learning what had happened to their uncle. And they provided me with the only picture that I had ever seen of Jesse James Payne. But they're in the process of trying to put their family back together. Part of what I found too is that they lost contact with Jesse James Payne's wife and infant daughter. They don't know what happened to them. So when we talk about destruction of the family unit, that is something that was very real. But conversely, in Live Oak, you have the founding of a chapter of the NAACP. The lynching of Willie James Howard becomes a spark that helps African Americans to begin organizing and campaigning for their civil rights in that community.
Let's take a break. We're speaking with Dr. Tamika Bradley Hobbs. She's a professor of history and the university historian at Florida Memorial University. I want to mention that Professor Hobbs will be at Books and Books in Coral Gables tonight at 6:30. That's 265 Aragon Avenue. And if you want to turn out, it's 6:30, correct?
6:30 is the time.
Correct. Okay. We're talking about her book, Democracy Abroad, Lynching at Home, Racial Violence in Florida. Our last break. We'll be right back.
Hey, And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and author Dr. Tamika Bradley Holmes. She's a Florida Memorial University history professor. We're talking about her book, Democracy Abroad, Lynching at Home, Racial Violence in Florida.
Your book, of course, focuses on these four lynchings. But just to put things in perspective, if you would talk about the incident that occurred in 2003 in Belglade, that's in our backyard, mm-hmm. And how it brings to light this historical distrust that still pervades many African Americans in Florida, mm-hmm. at least in Florida. 2003, we're talking about, 14 years ago.
Yes. That was around the time that I was finishing my graduate work at Florida State. But there was this case that was in the news involving an African-American man by the name of Ray Golden down in Belglade. He'd been found one morning by his mother hanging from bed sheets in a tree in his grandmother's yard. And there was an investigation, and the investigation came back from local law enforcement that it was a suicide. And that was a conclusion that was widely rejected in the African American community. There was a lot of suspicion because Ray Golden had been dating a white woman, and not just any white woman, but the daughter of a local law enforcement officer. And so, again, knowing the history, knowing what interracial sex and dating had meant at a certain period of time, there was a lot of suspicion that there had been a lynching, that Ray Golden had indeed been lynched. And so it ends up being just an event that festers in the Belglade community. Martin Luther King III is invited down. He has Ray Golden's mother come up to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference meeting and gives her the mic, gains international attention. The ultimate result is that the original claim of suicide does stand, but that incident to me really illuminated the role that this ghost of history still plays in African American communities. And I think it's still very much with us. When we talk about the way that African American community reacted to Trayvon Martin, the way that they reacted to Jordan Edwards, the most recent case in Texas, you know, we are used to law enforcement officials, some of them, who do not have the best interest of Black people in mind. As you read my book, you'll see that time and time again. In Florida during this period, you could not be elected to office as law enforcement officer if you did not have a reputation for being hard on Black people. Mm-hmm. They were the enforcers of the racial hierarchy throughout the state and throughout the region. And so you think about that and think about how that has then infiltrated into the way that African American people think about the police. It's the roots of the animosity that we sometimes see and experience. And more than that, it's the distrust. There is an inherent in many parts of our community, an inherent distrust of law enforcement that has been learned over time. And I still think when I talk to audiences, when I talk to whites in particular, and they're absorbing the story that I'm telling in this book, it is astounding to them that these things could take place. I mean, when we talk about World War II, this is a time when FDR is putting out the four freedoms, you know, that we should have freedom of expression, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. African Americans had a really hard time contending with that last element, being free from fear. Lynching was terrorism that was always present and was, you know, tacitly supported by the white community and actively played out by the law enforcement.
How about 1940s Florida and the Ku Klux Klan? I know during that period, the Klan would parade on Flagler Street here in Miami.
Well, they were born here. I didn't know that. Is that correct?
No.
It wasn't. Okay. I thought it was given birth. I thought Florida gave birth to the KKK.
How influential was the Klan in the decade of the 40s?
By the 40s, you know, Florida has always, in the early 20th century, had the reputation among the national Klan of being one of the hotbeds of Klan activity. In the 1920s, they claimed that up to a third of their members were in Florida. Over the next couple of decades, you will see the infiltration of the KKK into the law enforcement system. And that's a legacy that we still kind of struggle with even today. But Florida has always had a very strong Klan presence. When we talk about the bombings that take place here in Miami in the 1950s and 60s, that was the Klan. When we talk about the murder of Harry Tyson Moore and his wife, Harriet, that was the Klan. And so they're here and they're present and very active throughout this period.
We don't have that much time. We have about 5 minutes. I'd like to talk a little bit about Florida Memorial University. It's the only historically black university in South Florida right now. But it has had its own struggles with violence and racism. So just give us a little history.
Sure.
And how it came to be in South Florida.
Right. Interestingly enough, Florida Memorial was founded in 1879 in my hometown, up in Suwannee County in Live Oak, 14 years after emancipation. It's being put in place by Black Baptists who want to train their children and grandchildren, cultivate teachers and preachers. And so they were established there, but by 1892, there was strife and friction between the white power structure in the town and the school, and there are a series of drive-bys, shootings that take place. And the decision is made by the principal then, Matthew Gilbert, who's also the head pastor at Bethel Baptist in Jacksonville, that they're going to leave Live Oak and go to Jacksonville. So they go there, 1892, and found the Bethel Baptist Academy. The Florida Institute in Live Oak continues to operate, but they have this new school. So the school's in Jacksonville. It thrives for a number of years. By the time that the city starts to grow, they get landlocked. They get an invitation from the city of St. Augustine in 1918 to relocate to the old Hanson Plantation, which had ironically been one of the largest sugar plantations in the entire state. So that becomes the new campus of what was then known as the Florida Normal and Industrial Institute. And they have a industrial model. They're making brooms, bricklaying, carpentries, all that type of stuff that's taking place there. Racial strife will again raise its head, this time in the 1950s. Students in 1959 and 1960 at the campus sit in at the local Woolworths. Later, you have Dr. Robert Hayling who comes to town and begins to lead the proper civil rights movement that, came to national attention when he invites Martin Luther King Jr. to town. And this is on the eve of the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So many people have started to refer to Robert Hayling as the father of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. While we win that battle, the war is still raging as far as civil rights is concerned, and there's a lot of animosity in St. Augustine toward Florida Memorial. And so the board and its president realize what's happening, and they begin to seek out a new location, which happens to be South Florida. But that is going to be accelerated in April 4th, 1968, when King is assassinated. There's a cross that's burned on the front lawn of the college. And after closing for 2 weeks, Roel Perrier, who's then the president, makes the decision that, hey, we've got to go. We've got to go now. So the following semester, fall of 1968, they begin operating in South Florida near the Opelika Airport, which is now Miami Gardens, as Florida Memorial College. And so not once but twice, Florida Memorial has had to move because of racial strife. It's a fascinating story. I refer to Florida Memorial as the most mobile college that one could find.
Well, let's hope it stays where it is.
Our 50th anniversary is next year, so we've been in South Florida for 50 years.
How large a student body does the university have?
We are around 1,300 right now.
And I see that just a week ago, during your commencement ceremony, Trayvon Martin was awarded a Bachelor of Science degree posthumously.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes. Sabrina Fulton is an alum of our school. And back in 2012...
That's Trayvon's mother.
Trayvon's mother, yes. Back in 2012, as there was a national effort to try to get an investigation into what had happened to her son, we just couldn't take George Zimmerman's version of what had happened, students from our campus went up and participated in that national rally in March. But ever since then, we have developed a relationship. The Trayvon Martin Foundation is on our campus, and this was just another effort of keeping his memory alive, that he was a young man full of potential, and who knows what he could have been.
Any new book project?
No, but you have the Miami Shores People of Color project.
Yeah, interestingly enough, some of my work has taken me into race dialogue. I've been working with a group, Miami Shores People of Color, over the last year or so, and we've staged several race dialogues in that community and in Miramar. We have a couple coming up in July 15th and 22nd. And it operates from the foundation that part of white privilege is not having to learn Black history. And so my book, Democracy Abroad, has and my knowledge of African-American history has helped to fill a very critical gap and build a foundation for common understanding between people of different racial backgrounds. So that's been a pleasant surprise. I've enjoyed it tremendously.
Well, it's been a very interesting hour. And your Books and Books appearance?
Tonight at 6:30, yes. Books and Books in Coral Gables. And that Miami Shores People of Color, it's MSPOC.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
If you want to look that up online.
Yeah. And a painful book, but an important book, Democracy Abroad, Lynching at Home, Racial Violence in Florida. Dr. Tamika Bradley Holmes, an assistant professor of history and the university historian at Florida Memorial University and the interim chair in the Department of Social Sciences. It's an award-winning book. We thank you so much.
Thank you for the chance to be here.
It's been our pleasure.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Topical Current's lead producer is Richard Ives. Today's technical direction from Peter J. Jason Zebka is online creative director, Polly Landis, associate producer. And it's easy to download our free audio archive of each program at our website, that's WLRN.org. Also, the iTunes podcast, as well as the Topical Current's Facebook page.
And you're going on vacation.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Thank you for letting me do so.
We'll miss you.
Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. Thursday, Bonnie returns with Sun Sentinel consumer columnist Doreen Christensen, followed by Linda Gassenheimer's report about a new authentic Indian cuisine restaurant in Dadeland. The veggies are homegrown by the restaurant. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.